Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Last week, we considered the various ways we appropriate things as me and mine, thereby producing our personal footprint or defining our personality to our detriment. We talked about how we appropriate sensuality, how we appropriate views, and how we appropriate conduct and observances. Let's begin today with the fourth and final type of appropriation, how we appropriate self-doctrine. I see, I want, I act, I control, I used to be little but now I'm big, I think, therefore I am. The I here is the self, atta. We experience the self as an experiencer, an agent, needy and afraid, enduring, standing apart from other things and other people in all the things we do, a fixed point with change unfolding all around it. Then we conceptualize the self as an existing thing and develop views about it. There seems to have been a number of theories of the self at the time of the Buddha having to do with its material or immaterial existence, its finiteness or infinitude, whether it's conscious or not, whether it survives death or is annihilated at death, etc., many of which are current today. But we also readily seem to make up our own theories on demand. When we presume one of these doctrines and then appropriate it, it often makes a big difference in how we frame our life, our goals, our practice. Self-doctrine in Pali is attawada, atta self or soul, and wada, doctrine or theory. We discussed in previous talks on birth how the self-doctrines of annihilationism and eternalism make a difference in spiritual practice. I presume it's because of the implications of self-doctrine for framing our practice that the Buddha distinguished this particular form of view as one of the four objects of appropriation, rather than simply including it as another type of appropriation of views. We also noted that the middle way exhibits the most beneficial features of both annihilationism and eternalism, but presumes no doctrine of self at all, seemingly unique among the world's religions. In fact, for the Buddha, the scourge of the self is at the heart of the human pathology. It begins upstream as a conceptual artifact of contact, then leads to feeling, to craving, to appropriation, and to becoming. Appropriation and becoming escalate the problem into a scourge. For these links not the self into a personality, a self with a full range of assets and self-interest, a personal footprint in the thick of things that must be defended and maintained. And just as we develop self-doctrine from self, we develop personality view from personality. We become convinced of the essential reality of me. This thing, ranging over the five aggregates, really is me or mine or part of me or I am part of it. At this point, we are in deep trouble. So how does appropriation cease? We can limit the process of appropriation step by step through a number of practices detailed in the early Buddhist texts. The complete eradication of appropriation and thereby of becoming and samsara will depend on work done upstream. The aggregates serve to structure most of these practices. In fact, the Khanda Samyutta, the connected discourses on the aggregates, which includes 159 suttas for reflection and constitutes 131 pages in the Wisdom Edition, is primarily aimed at weakening appropriation. Clearly, the Buddha saw this as a primary locus of practice. So let's reflect on the aggregates of appropriation. Why the aggregates? Okay, it makes sense to frame the world of experience as consisting of heaps of awareness events, each carrying some objective content. For this is a counterweight to what we normally do, which is to look past cognition to appropriate directly what we presume are substantial and existent out there in the objective world. Cars, people, plunder, facts, and even ourselves. Things that we presume would exist even if we did not experience them. It's their very promise of substantial existence that allows us to take our appropriation seriously. We easily forget that in order for us to appropriate them, we must first construct them cognitively by piecing them together like a jigsaw puzzle from heaps of awareness events. Understanding what we appropriate in this way brings our world into the realm of practice. The expression aggregates of appropriation actually intersects two discordant categories, aggregates as cognitively constructed and appropriations as out there existing independent of experience, and oh so alluring and substantial. When we see our precious appropriations so constructed, we see shoddy merchandise with cognitive seams left over from their presumption. Okay, this is a clever sleight of the Buddha's hand, but why the particular modes of awareness, appearance, feeling, perceptions, formations, and cognizance? They're not even discrete categories. A little reflection reveals that feelings and perceptions are also formations, and that all modes of awareness are also instances of cognizance, broadly speaking. Although they overlap technically, the labels for these modes have differing semantic centers. Each is used to bring out a particular aspect of awareness. For instance, appearance, feeling, and perception are typically experienced as immediate, requiring no noticeable effort. Formations and cognizance can be much more deliberate. In formations, we notice that we derive wholes from the parts or make thoughtful connections and inferences. In cognizance, we find deep processing. We see directly one side of a house, yet we are aware of a three-dimensional object with sides all around. In terms of semantic centers, the five aggregates are modes of awareness listed in ascending order of cognitive complexity. We'll investigate all of these in much more detail in the course of these talks on dependent co-arising. I'm convinced that the primary reason for these particular categories of awareness has to do with bringing the aggregates onto the cushion. As the mind stills in samadhi, the experienced world begins progressively to retreat from the more cognitively complex modes of awareness, from cognizance, then from formations, then from perception, then from feeling, finally leaving the bare awareness of appearance. As this proceeds, what constitutes the world out there, once presumed to be independent of cognizance, appears to retreat as well, and the immediate experiences of craving and appropriation also retreat. We begin to notice, as the mind stills, that our world undergoes a noticeable shift, that it becomes progressively less differentiated and that the substantiality of what we otherwise appropriate becomes more obscure. Because the aggregates really represent levels of cognitive unfolding of our experiential world, a cognitive overlaying of different facets of reality, we might notice in our practice at which point in this progression the unfolding, craving, or appropriation appear. This further highlights the cognitive conditioning of our appropriations and actually allows us to associate them with specific modes of awareness. For instance, what aspects of my chariot do I identify with? If it's the shine of the chrome trimmings, my appropriation centers on appearance and maybe feeling. If the quality of the wooden parts, the length of the yoke, or the diameter of the wheels, then on perception. If the many uses I find in my chariot and the prestige I gain by appearing on the byways and crossroads in it, then on formations. If the chariot as a whole rather than on any specific aspect, then on cognizance. Unsubstantiality is a primary theme in dependent co-arising. This is our first encounter with it. In support of this analysis, we notice that reflection on the aggregates is one of the practices mentioned for mindful observation of phenomena in the Satipatthana, a practice that we carry into samadhi. Impermanence is the partner of unsubstantiality. And so, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu sees as impermanent appearance, which is actually impermanent. That is his right view. Seeing rightly, he experiences revulsion. With the destruction of delight comes the destruction of lust. With the destruction of lust comes the destruction of delight. With the destruction of delight and lust, the mind is liberated and is said to be well liberated. This passage is repeated as for appearance, so for feeling, perception, formations, and finally cognizance. Let's reflect on the danger of appropriation. What we appropriate is not only insubstantial, it gets us into a heap of trouble. At this point, the Buddha applies an oft-repeated formula referring to gratification, danger, and escape. The gratification of the aggregates is the pleasure and joy dependent on the khandhas. The danger is that the aggregates are impermanent, suffering, and subject to change. The escape is the removal of desire and lust for the aggregates. The Buddha states, with regard to this formula, so long as I did not directly know the gratification, the danger, and the escape, in the case of the five aggregates of appropriation, I did not claim to have awakened. Our job with regard to gratification is to understand the appeal of objects that lead to their appropriation, tracing this appeal back to craving, as we'll do next week. Fulfills this task and reveals that the appeal is generally misleading. Reflecting on the five aggregates of appropriation, we ask, what is the danger here? The five aggregates of appropriation are painful, a root of suffering. What we appropriate, we want to be reliable. When we discover it is instead impermanent, then we have a problem. The uninstructed worldling regards appearance thus. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. That appearance of his changes and alters. With the change and alteration of appearance, there arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. This passage is repeated as for appearance, so for feeling, perception, formations, and finally cognizance. Impermanence is the reason that craving leads to suffering. I often advise students that if they acquire a new car, the best thing that they can do for themselves is to get it over with. Take out a hammer and put a few dents in it. Otherwise, they will prolong the misery that comes with the mere anticipation of that first dent or scratch. The escape from the objects of appropriation is renunciation. Do we really need all this stuff and all these responsibilities? Some of our wisest grandparents say periodically, "You know, you don't own things, they own you." And we nod in assent. We think back at how happy we were as students when we didn't own anything, and are inspired to reduce our personal footprint. The Buddha gave us a perspective on this. Bhikkhus, what do you think? If people carried off the grass, sticks, branches, and leaves in this Jeta grove, or burned them and did what they liked with them, what do you think? Would you think people are carrying us off, or burning us, or doing what they like with us? No, venerable sir. Why not? Because that is neither ourself nor what belongs to ourself. So too, bhikkhus, whatever is not yours, abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. What is it that is not yours? Appearance is not yours. Abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. This passage is repeated as for appearance, so for feeling, perception, formations, and cognizance. Our problems will be gone if we simply regard the objects we otherwise appropriate the way we regard grass, sticks, branches, and leaves as not us, as not ours, as not part of us and as not including us, but as sitting out there in the environment beyond our personal footprint. Most of the practices of the Khanda Samyutta involve prying up the identification with the aggregates. This is a recurring refrain. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. He does not consider appearance as self, or self as possessing appearance, or appearance as in self, or self as in appearance. This passage is repeated as for appearance, so for feelings, perceptions, formations, and cognizance. Once we burn ourselves on a hot stove, we tend not to touch it again. Once we're fully cognizant of the dangers of appropriation, letting go requires little effort. Just as kids lose their lust and desire for a sandcastle, then destroy and scatter it, so we must destroy our lust and desire for the aggregates and destroy and scatter what we have built. This is a metaphor that's enacted by Tibetan monks who painstakingly construct a mandala of colored sand over many days, then sweep it away all at once upon completion. We don't actually need to sell the car we've appropriated, nor give up the view, nor the practice. Some of these may actually be useful in our lives, certainly Buddhist practices. We need only take a backward step or avoid the forward step in the first place so as to avoid appropriation. This is the somewhat more subtle practice of non-fashioning. About this specifically with respect to jhana practice, the Buddha said, "But a true man considers thus, non-fashioning, even with the attainment of the first jhana, has been declared by the Blessed One, for in whatever way they presume, the fact is ever other than that. So putting non-fashioning first, he neither lauds himself nor disparages others because of his attainment of the first jhana. This too is the character of a true man. In Pali, non-fashioning is atammayata, literally, not made of that-ness. We don't need to turn our assets into becoming. Many years ago, I was ordained as a Zen priest. Zen priests train to perform many ceremonial rituals, wear robes in prescribed ways, offer incense and bow at prescribed times, and so on, a lot more formalities than Theravada monks observe. That auspicious day of my ordination, my teacher told me, "A Zen priest does special things. He is not a special person." This advice was an important hedge against my tendency toward pride. This was a warning not to fashion myself according to whatever skills or public attention I would acquire. Assets, including personal qualities, are like tools that happen to be available and should be put to good use when it's fitting, but then put down. We don't need to identify with them nor carry them with us. Similarly, the Buddha refers to the sense in which a monk is virtuous, but not fashioned by virtue. This is to continue to live virtually, yet with no thought whatever that this virtue is me or mine. Just do it. Appropriation is a link that responds well to practice. If a bhikkhu's mind has become dispassionate towards appearance, it is liberated from the fermentations by non-appropriation. By being liberated, it is steady. By being steady, it is content. By being content, he is not agitated. Being unagitated, he personally attains nibbana. He understands destroyed is birth, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being. This passage is repeated as for appearance, so for feeling, perceptions, formations, and finally cognizance.